Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with Anna Crean. Anna is an award-winning journalist and the author of Night Games and Into the Woods, amongst many others. Today she's joining me to discuss her first novel, Act of Grace. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. We record on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I want to acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ongoing connection to the land. Their stories are the original stories, and I pay my respects. Final Draft explores the best of Australia's books, writing, and literary culture as featured on 2SER. The Great Conversations podcast is a chance for you to hear more of these discussions. It's actually just one of the fantastic literary podcasts from 2SER. If you need a book recommendation, why not check out the 2SER Book Club, which releases every Tuesday, with stacks of great books to discover wherever you get your podcasts. Act of Grace entwines the stories of Robbie, Jerry, and Nassim, taking us from their early lives into the present. Jerry grows up in fear of his father, Tui, a returned veteran who raises Jerry with a heavy hand. Robbie must confront her own identity when the onset of her father's dementia means that he no longer recognizes his family. Nassim is growing up in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, where she attracts the attention not only of the dictator, but his cruel and psychotic son. Join me as we discover Anna Crean's Act of Grace. My name is Andrew Popel, and I'm joined in the studio by Anna Crean. Anna is the author of the award-winning Night Games and Into the Woods, amongst many other titles. And today, I am very fortunate she's joining me to discuss her first novel. It is called Act of Grace. Anna, welcome. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I confessed off air, I am still working through this novel. I loved it, but it feels like the sort of novel that love, like there's so many complex emotions going on. I want to tell people about it. Act of Grace, it entwines the stories of Robbie, Jerry, and Nassim, taking us from their early lives into the present. Jerry grows up in fear of his father, Tui, a returned veteran who raises Jerry with a heavy hand. Robbie must confront her own identity when the onset of her father Danny's dementia means that he no longer recognizes his family. And Nassim grows up in Saddam Hussein's Iraq and attracts the attention of not only the dictator, but his cruel, psychotic son. I am entranced by this novel. It's been one of those reading experiences. It's still with me. I'm very fortunate to have you here to help me process some of these thoughts. And I want to start with your three. This is a character-rich novel, and it seems unfair to just pick out Robbie, Jerry, and Nassim, but they are very much the threads that bring the novel together. Mm. They're very distinct characters, and the early chapters of the book are quite contained. Each character also represents these vastly different world views and experiences. Did they all begin for you in the same narrative space?
Well, in a way... They began with Tui, who you haven't mentioned, who was Jerry's father, who is the returned soldier. And I guess originally when I, you know, decided, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to follow the novel, I was just thinking about him, and I became obsessed with Iraq and reading and researching all about our time in Iraq during the Iraq War, and that I was only ever doing that with the intention of writing him up as a character. But then I had this really strange few weeks in my study where suddenly I was in Baghdad, writing Baghdad and writing this Iraqi character, and then Saddam Hussein became a character, and I really wasn't expecting that, because I think part of me was still thinking like a journalist, like you do all your research, but you can't really write about where you haven't been. And then when I started to develop Nassim as a character and write about her time in Baghdad, then her flight through to Syria, I realized the huge leap that you can make with fiction that you can't do with nonfiction.
So what was that research like, and what was that leap moment for you? Because, of course, I guess as readers, we understand that not only can we make that leap, we rely on authors to do that for us. That's the power of literature. But what was it like for you realizing that you could do that?
It was incredibly liberating. It was fun. And it was about trusting my impulses. Journalism really took a front sort of seat for me for so long. I always loved fiction, but journalism got all the green lights. And so when I did finally decide, okay, it's time to work on a piece of fiction, I felt like I sat in my study and found my fiction muscle really, really overweight, really flabby, really unfit. And I was like, oh my God, I have to exercise this muscle because it's just been so neglected. So I think for a year or two, I was just pushing and prodding and trying to understand it again and how to trust the path I was going to go on. And so my original process was very much like how I would approach journalism, which was just pure and utter intense research and absorption into a world. But then the process of typing was quite different.
Can you think back, or have you gone back to those earlier drafts? Does Nassim look different as a character before you had that freeing, that liberating moment?
Nassim was never a character.
She was never a character. So you were in Baghdad and it wasn't really populated in the way that it is now populated in Act of Grace.
Very much so. I would never, when I sat down to write this, that was never part of the deal.
Wow.
Nassim was not meant to be part of it.
That's fascinating. You've noted, I do want to come back to Tui. There was a reason I've sort of neglected him so far, but you've noted that you began with Tui, his experience of conflict, and war really rages for each of the characters. For Nassim, it is the war that she must survive. For Jerry, it's the legacy that rears up daily into his violence.
Yeah.
But what really fascinated me was Robbie. And it actually, for me, or perhaps for the narrative, perhaps at least for Jerry, it takes Jerry's experience in America to show us how war can operate at the level of a government against its people. This in turn, it speaks to the ongoing and the intergenerational trauma that Robbie and her father suffer. Jerry, in the narrative, Jerry felt like a fool. You really take us through this process, and he felt like a fool for not having seen this sooner and for it having taken a whole nother continent to help him realize it. What are your reflections on that? Is this a revelation we're still making or yet to make as a country?
Yeah, I feel like I think many of us would recognize ourselves in Jerry. He has this experience and makes these friendships whilst travelling through America that make him realise that everything he has learned and everything he has accepted and assumed is questionable, all the way down to maps that he follows to get from A to B. He realises that rivers aren't necessarily their original route through the land, that they've been altered and rerouted and dammed and all those kind of... those things that we take for granted and our education hasn't really dealt with or hasn't dared unpick. And I do feel like Jerry is having that brain explosion of a moment when you're like, oh, my brain is nowhere near as ignited and as lit up as it needs to be. I've been sort of just followed my nose through this dusty, banal path of education. I haven't questioned anything I've been told. And then he hooks up with this really vibrant, radical, a clever crew of people in America and realizes that nothing is as he thought it was. Yeah.
I realize we've jumped right to the pretty much to the end of the book. I think we're speaking sufficiently vaguely that we're not really spoiling anything. And this is a narrative. This is very much like the crew that Jerry hooks up with. I can't spoil that journey by telling you where they end up because this book is the experience. This book is inside the van day to day with them is an analogy that I might not use again, but you have to feel your way through this book. All of your protagonists, they have a legacy of these strong parental figures whose influence forces them to both confront, but it also complicates their present. And so I thought, let's start with Nassim. Mm. And I'm going to just note that I'm really unnaturally kind of teasing out narrative threads that are actually woven together in Act of Grace in just a way that just I loved. I can't tell everyone to go out and read the book. But so we have Nassim. Her mother is this, she's a lauded progressive poet under a regime that tolerates no dissidents.
That's right.
Her commitment to feeling her art often leaves Nassim feeling somewhat inadequate. And this is constantly reflected back in Nassim's piano playing, which she is virtuoso, but is criticized by her mother for not having feeling. Nassim also attracts the favor of a ruthless dictator's son who horrifically abuses her. I don't think there are any words that I can use to kind of describe that. And probably even for yourself, that would have been difficult to approach with words, knowing the reality of that. As you traveled with Nassim, though, did you get a sense of which of these was hardest for her to reconcile? And how did you approach that?
I think for Nassim, a large part of her struggle was, being in the shadow of her extraordinary mother, an accomplished poet, but also the knowledge that her mother chose art over everything. Mm. Her mother chose art over family, over her own life, over her over Nassim's life. She put all their family in jeopardy by choosing art and truth-telling through poetry. And I think Nassim, by sort of constantly having to shake off her skin and renew herself, was constantly, in order to survive, shedding identity. And it was, she was literally a flotsam, a piece of history that was being pinballed to these whims and woes of a regime, of her mother, her strong-willed mother. And yet she chose survival. She chose it over her art. She chose it over over truth. And I think that that's a really important, complex idea that maybe we need to struggle with more. We're often it's sort of in progressive sort of cultural discussions, we're quite punitive in sort of this commitment to a higher mindedness or a righteousness or a truth, and that doesn't necessarily it's not necessarily how people can survive. People have to, telling the truth is not always. It might be noble. It might be briefly wonderful. It might even get you a couple hits of dopamine on the internet. But it's not always successful in the long view.
And Nassim's experience, and so ultimately she's able to flee Iraq. She comes through Syria. She gets to Australia, and her experience, her youth, that colours very much how she views the country, and she has some ideas that I think some people would recognise, the idea that we're a very young country and we sort of celebrate our age. I think there's a moment where she's looking at a building that's marked with the date 1854. I was going to say 49. That's because I was in Hobart recently and I was looking at a lot of buildings dating from 1849.
There you go.
And she thinks it's so young. It's so young to celebrate. But then she also has attitudes that I think others would find more difficult around the true meaning of people wanting to flee. And she doesn't believe that as a country we should be more open because... In her own heart, she knows what she has had to do to get here.
So there's I really wanted to explore that, that that I what Australia would look like to such an outside eye that has thousands and thousands of years of history and is and then to come to this country and go, oh my God, like Nassim kind of thinks Australia is pretty pathetic, basically. It's celebration of a really of maybe even not even being toilet trained in the history of time, basically. You know, it's a very young country in that sense, not the actual continent and the original people of Australia, but the country as Australia calls itself and the myth that we create. But, you know, she is very, I mean, people often talk about this, how often the harshest judge on, say, a migrant or on immigration is migrants themselves. And I think it's, in part, that can be called a reaction to the knowledge that migrants are not innocent. There's this idea that you can only be worthy of help or humanitarian aid if you present yourself as completely blameless and innocent and a victim. And, you know, again, I think that's a really simplistic view of humanity. People come with baggage and they come with, you know, a lot of people have done things in order to survive that we would crucify should it find itself in our court of law, because our court of law is still based around these bizarre premises of good and evil, whereas, you know, the history of so many countries and so many conflicts, you just can't sort of divvy it out as simply as that.
And I guess those black and white, this good and evil notions, this sort of binary is forever tainted by its background, because of course we have, I do really want to come to Tui, but I'm going to push him back just a little bit, a little bit longer. But of course he also has acts that perhaps he hasn't, you know, faced fully in his past that would be complicated by that good and evil view. I did want to look at Robbie. We've given short shrift to Robbie so far. She's perhaps one of my perhaps my favourite character. I think I enjoyed following her story the most. So her father, Danny, he has, at a very early part in the story, he has his Indigenous heritage forced upon him by a teacher at the school where he works, someone who, I guess, to a lot of the country, you know, looks like a bit of a white hat, liberal, best intentioned. And you do complicate, again, a clean relationship that we have with this teacher. But he hasn't chosen to seek this out. Then when he's in the home following the onset of dementia, he is reunited with his mother's family in a way that sort of almost he cruelly may never actually get to know them because of the dementia that he's experiencing. And how does Danny's story, though, because it was very hard going alongside Danny and his story, and how does that impact Robbie, though, and the decisions she makes? Because she then goes on to become an artist, to engage across Australia with different people.
Yeah. Robbie is interesting because, as same with her father, in the sense that they are grappling with these very different ideas of what it might mean to be Indigenous, you know, in a way having blood versus having culture. And Danny had no culture. And so Robbie is grappling with who she might be and what people would see her as. And her father, very early on before dementia kicks in, warns her to say that she's Italian, to not even bother going there, because the clothing of identity that people will keep trying to put on her just won't fit. But as she is a feisty personality, she's an artist, and artists are seekers, and they're constantly seeking out identity. They're constantly trying to make patterns of stories and to evoke them in a certain way. So she doesn't say she's Italian, but she doesn't say she's Indigenous either. Mm. She is... she's grappling with the history of the country and where she might fit in it.
Does this have anything to do then with, I mean, I guess what we can see broadly is, especially in people who really want to wear their progressiveness and their wokeness like a badge, kind of a fetishizing of culture. I mean, there is a moment in the book that I'd only just thought about where Robbie and Nassim are living in the same unit block and they meet. Mm. And I think it's pretty much their first interaction. Robbie asks Nassim to teach her how to wear the headdress that she's wearing, and she decides she pitches it as a project to her university tutor that she wants to wear it for a period of time. She wants to understand the racism. She in effect sort of fetishizes Nassim and her identity to better understand it, and it very much looks like some of that, you know, lowercase l liberal sort of wokeness that I referred to earlier.
Yeah, yes. And she comes to that realization that she ditches the project eventually. but I also think it was a commendable, naive process in a young artist's life is how can I put myself in someone else's shoes? And that the realization can only be found through doing it, and it might seem naive and it might seem stupid, but I would never take that away from someone's journey of exploration. I think it's important for people to realize that to try and understand racism, to try and understand what it might be to be someone else, how simple things such as clothing and outward markers can really affect a person's, literally affect a person's path through the city, how those reactions will do take a toll, but also to recognise that it's far deeper. Identity is far deeper than any garment you might don. You can't turn it into an art project and say that you've got it.
Yeah, and it strikes me that it would be regressive if every person to come to understanding needed to take a little slice of experience with them. And I mean, we have a culture at the moment where across a broad range of issues, a large number of people struggle to just believe people that say they've been the victim of violence, believe people that are saying that they've suffered at the hands of something that others claim doesn't even exist. And just the idea that we have to somehow experience it or we need some proof of it feels a little bit regressive writ large.
Definitely.
So this is going to be a plainly obvious statement after everything I've just been saying. As I read, I was constantly troubled by the ways that I was feeling for each of the characters. I mean, I definitely had a huge affection for Robbie. Nassim's story couldn't fail to touch me. Jerry was interesting, but Tui. I want to get to Tui, and I wondered how far empathy can extend. What can I judge outside my own life experience, which is something we were just touching on? Tui in particular, he troubled me because his story is potted with its own tragedy. And undoubtedly, he, as a young man, went and tried to do something that he believed was noble, that he believed was brave, that he believed was good. But his attitude is also repugnant. He is the sort of person that you would have to take on, except you would probably be afraid of him. And I wondered, though, is that him or is that me? did you want your characters to complicate the reader's sensibility in this way?
Well, Tui is almost representative of almost all my journalism in the sense that you often meet subjects whose behaviour is reprehensible, but you can't help but have empathy and a sense of insight into who they are and how they came to be who they are, and sometimes even communicate and connect with someone. You might be talking to I've spoken to prisoners who have done horrible things, and sometimes end up having a joke with them or a little connection or a little chuckle. And I feel like Tui is that. He's I also feel incredibly sad for him. He's a man that is so knotted in fury and so completely barricaded from the people around him. He makes life a nightmare for his son. He makes life a nightmare for his wife, but he is actually in the nightmare. Mm. It doesn't stop for him. And sometimes I feel sometimes that people are really punitive towards that, that they that people can be horrible, and often with mental illness it's not a pretty thing. People can behave incredibly badly, can be nasty pieces of work. But I do think that sometimes it's important for us to remember that whilst we may brush against them and get a taste of that horror and that nightmare, it is important to remember that person who is sick, who's actually sick, can't ever get out of that nightmare. And I feel like that's what Tui is.
So off air, we started off talking about your journalism and then about fiction, the role that both of them play, the ways people engage differently with them. And I wanted to sort of close this up with just thinking about how for many of us, reading, narrative reading, fiction reading, it offers a space to glean meaning and purpose in a world that is so much bigger than ourselves. Some of us will never travel except through the pages of books. In reflecting on her mother's writing, and in fact, I think it was her mother's work and also one of her colleagues' writing, Nassim had a somewhat different view. Poetry, she sometimes thought, is mere rope, something you tugged at until finally, if you were lucky, a pail of water was hauled to the surface. Are we always able to overlay meaning on a text? Should we? Like, would you have your readers do this to Act of Grace? To keep tugging until a pail of water emerged?
Well, yeah, but I think it's the writer's job to put the bucket of water down there. and I think sometimes you don't. You don't get a bucket of water. You just keep getting mere rope. And, yeah, I think some texts are difficult to get into, and I do think that I was actually just mentioning this just before to someone that I've had these experiences with novels where I literally say, consider Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. I remember trying to read that when I was 20 and seriously having, like, I could look up from a page and go, I have no idea what just happened. I couldn't form the sentences. I couldn't put the words together. It was a complete and utter mystery to me. It took me 10 years to pick it up and go, oh, why was it so hard before? Like, I do actually think the reader needs to continually transform and change in order to receive literature. And if you might not be able to get that bucket of water at a particular point in your life, but 10 years down the track, you might try again and the water is extremely easy to haul up and you're like, wow, I can't believe what's changed. Has the book changed or have I changed? And of course it's the reader who's changed.
I think that's something very much that is going to happen with my experience of Act of Grace. And I think for many readers, I'm speaking with Anna Crean. We are discussing Act of Grace. And I hope I have instilled on you, the listener, just some of the wonder and some of the discovery that I got from my reading of this. Anna, thank you so much for coming in and helping me work through my reading of this. If only we could all be so fortunate.
Thank you, Andrew.
That's it for this great conversation with Anna Crean. Anna's new novel is Act of Grace, and it's out now through Black Ink Books. Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER's Broadway Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. To keep up with the latest in books, writing and literary culture, follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER and click subscribe in your podcast app. You'll get a new Great Conversation every week. My name is Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. So till then, happy reading.